Members, I call the meeting of the House Property Tax and Local Government Finance Committee to order. We'll begin with the approval of the minutes. Is there a motion to approve the minutes of last meeting?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Representative Frankie moves to approve the minutes of January 25th, 2017 meeting of this body. Any amendments or other discussion about the amendments or about the minutes? Hearing none, all in favor of approving the minutes of January 25th, 2017, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes, and those minutes are adopted. And members, we're gonna juggle the agenda a little bit here. Actually, Representative Carlson is going to be first, followed by House File 514, then House File 414, and then the Sundin Bill 497 will be fourth. And with that, welcome Representative Carlson with your bill, House File 427. And members, he brought treats. Now, this is not a demand that this chair has brought, but Representative David's and his influence in this area, I think, has spilled over. So we'd like to thank Representative Carlson for providing the calorie-packed and, of course, nutritious, too, Representative Carlson.
Absolutely, absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, the donuts there are from Sunrise Bakery in Bloomington, baked fresh every morning, so please enjoy.
Oh, awesome. Thank you. With that, let's move forward with House File 427, and Representative Nelson moves House File 427 be discussed with the committee and then laid over for possible inclusion.
That's my motion, sir.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. And Representative Carlson, please proceed with your bill, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House File 427 is a technical fix intended to clean up existing statutory language by clarifying that local lodging taxes apply to online travel companies, or OTCs, such as Expedia and Travelocity. House File 427 simply clarifies that no matter how you book a hotel room, either through the official hotel website, by phone, or through an OTC, the amount of tax you pay should be the same. However, under current statute, this is not the case because OTCs base lodging taxes on the wholesale amount of the room charge, not the retail amount customers see when booking their stay. For the City of Bloomington, so as an example, for the City of Bloomington, this lower tax revenue equates to an estimated $500,000 annually, which would have been shared by the city, the Bloomington Convention and Visitors Bureau, and the South Loop Development Fund. In addition to Bloomington, 120 other cities and towns across the state impose lodging taxes for tourism purposes. That basically concludes my opening remarks. But before taking questions, I'd like to request that Shane Rutland, who's the director of the Bloomington Port Authority, and Paul Cummings from the Department of Revenue first be allowed to provide their testimony. They will explain some of the background and technical aspects on this issue and how they relate to this bill.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. And, sir, he introduced you, but I didn't catch your name. If you could introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Shane Rudlang, R-U-D-L-A-N-G. I'm the administrator of the Bloomington Port Authority. So the Bloomington Port Authority manages one of the funds that receives lodging tax in Bloomington, and that's why I'm here. As Representative Carlson stated, how a person books a hotel room in a city should not have an effect on how much tax is collected. It's a transparent transaction to a person going onto a website and clicking on book room from the Orbitz website or the Marriott.com website. So today, which website you use dictates how much tax you pay. And I know that Paul Cummings from the Department of Revenue has this in their technical bill, as they have for a number of years, and he may not be here because of us switching the order of the agenda this morning, or the chair switching the order of the agenda, should I say. But as Representative Carlson stated, the room sales are split up into two pieces for the purposes of discussing this: the wholesale price when you book through an OTC, and then the retail price. If a hotel room is listed as a retail price of $100, the OTC may get 20 of that, and the hotel may get 80 of that. And right now, the way the current statute is written, in some cities, the tax is only being applied to the wholesale price. And so that's in the weeds a little bit, and but it's an important fact. In previous years, we've had hoteliers, local businesses, local Minnesota-run businesses testify in support of this bill. This year, given people's schedules, we weren't able to get one of the two or three people that would normally have come and testify for this that I've got trained up, if you will, to understand this, and they're wholly in support of this. These are local Minnesota businesses, and the people that are currently benefiting from this perceived loophole in the tax law are out-of-state companies like Orbitz, Travelocity, Expedia, and such. And so this bill is really a tax fairness issue that helps Minnesota businesses so that the Minnesota hoteliers want to sell these rooms, and right now they're sometimes getting sold on Expedia, Travelocity, Orbitz, and the like, sometimes paying just a fraction less in taxes, but those fraction less in taxes multiplied over thousands and thousands of rooms through the years lead to real money that are hurting the general funds and not hurting mostly Minnesotans, really. This is a tax fairness and helping Minnesota business bill as we see it. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Is it Rudland?
Rudlang, yep.
Rudland, okay, yep. Thank you. Members, or is there anyone else who would like to testify? Mr. Carlson, are you here? Oh, the other Mr. Carlson. I have Mr. Joel Carlson on the list, but Mr. Gary Carlson, we'll take you as well.
Mr. Chair, we're actually going for a record today to see how many Carlsons we can have testify. So,
thank you, Representative Carlson. And how many Carlsons are in the audience?
Mr. Chair, I think Mr. Keith Carlson might be here, but I don't think he has a stake in this particular issue.
You could start your own party.
Members, my name is Gary Carlson. I'm with the League of Minnesota Cities, and our policy committees have discussed this issue for the past couple of years. As Representative Carlson indicated, there are about 120 cities affected by this particular ambiguity in state statute, and we have adopted a policy or have had a policy on our books for the past several years supporting exactly what this bill does. So we would really encourage you to consider and include this in the division report. We think it would be a good clarification in state law and take away the ambiguity in the application of the sales tax on lodging purchases by consumers.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you.
Anyone else would like to testify for or against the bill? Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Lucy Botzik, and I represent all the Convention Visitor Bureaus in Minnesota. And this is certainly a complex issue, and while we don't directly collect it, it's all the hoteliers that have the responsibility. I did some research on this a couple years ago, and there's a variety of practices out there. So our association certainly supports anything that makes this a fair and equitable collection process for everybody that's involved, and hopefully you will agree that that's a good goal.
Thank you, Ms. Botzik. Anyone else who would like to testify? Mm-hmm. And looks, Mr. Carlson, are you interested in testifying on this bill? Your timing is perfect.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I won't walk back to my chair and get my notes, Mr. Chairman. I think I can handle this one by rote. Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Joel Carlson. I own a legal research and government affairs business here in St. Paul, and I'm here in front of you today on behalf of TravelTech, which is a association of travel intermediaries, online travel companies, travel agents, and people that facilitate travel in Minnesota. And I know Representative Carlson brought treats today for his first excursion into this committee to clarify the legislature's original intent. If you wanted to bring treats the first time this bill was presented to the legislature, you would have to go back all the way to March of 2010. House File 3687 was introduced in the legislature to clarify the legislature's original intent to place this tax on travel intermediaries, and in the ensuing seven subsequent sessions, the legislature has declined to do that, and I'll tell you why. the legislature, when they first imposed a sales tax on the service of travel intermediaries, they never once amended the local lodging tax. And they did that for good reason. If you look at how local lodging taxes are collected and applied, you create an almost impossible scenario for travel intermediaries to comply. Local lodging taxes principally are collected locally, and you would take the hundreds, literally, of travel intermediaries and make them local taxpayers in every jurisdiction that has a local lodging tax, which are collected at different times, which have different rates, and you create a tax compliance nightmare for businesses trying to comply. And you need to know that there is no avoidance of tax in this situation. The tax on the price paid for lodging is paid, the lodging tax is paid completely by the hotelier. The sales tax that is imposed on companies like Priceline or Travelocity, Expedia, you know, we remit that to the state as a sales tax on our service. But we've never paid, and we have never believed that the legislature amended local lodging taxes. And I need to tell you why that is important, not just as a tax matter, but it's important for tourism as well in Minnesota. You know, tourism is one of the leading industries in Minnesota. It's the second largest sector of our economy. It employs over 240,000 people in Minnesota. It generates about 17% of our local of our sales tax statewide. And what happens when you look at this bill and you place the ability of the local unit of government to send to a travel intermediary what zip code they have to collect tax on, when you look at the technology, it's pretty easy for those same companies to say, I'm not going to market in those zip codes. I'm just not going to do that. I'm not going to do the hotel in Malacca because I don't want to risk being a taxpayer. And when you have this language that says this confirms our original intent going back to 7 years now, you have potentially created a tax liability for these companies who haven't been paying it because it was never applied to them. If you were to adopt that, you have potentially created a retroactive tax liability for something that really was never the case. So I urge you to have caution with this bill because it does have far-reaching implications. And trying to make all of these travel agents and online travel companies, tour groups, local lodging taxpayers is very problematic, and I urge caution. I'm glad I walked in at the right time, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for having me here, and I'm happy to answer questions for you.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. You know, you stumbled, Mr. Carlson, so many times, I don't know how you'd have done with your notes.
I've had a chance to be up to bat on this one.
You did well, Mr. Carlson. And with that, a question from Representative Hertaus.
Well, thank you, and Mr. Chair, the question of how much revenue is being lost because of the way the statute is being written right now, I think, is a difficult one to really figure out and to really have a tangible number on it. I travel quite a bit and to certain cities, and some cities are expensive, and I've learned over time that I can have the luxury, if you will, of knowing I have a place when I arrive and pay a premium by booking in advance. I've learned now, rather than paying $325 for a room in Washington, D.C., for example, that if I just wait till I get there, and depending on the flight, I can use one of the online services, and hotels realize that at a certain point in time in the evening, their opportunity to sell that room is diminishing quickly, and its revenue lost. So I can get that same room sometimes for $89 instead of $325. So how much revenue is really being lost? Without the online booking agency, I probably wouldn't stay at that hotel or within that city limit. So the sales tax is one number that's due if I book at $326, It's another tax, a much lower tax, and less revenue that's going to be collected at $99 or $89. So who's going to decide what's the fair price for the room? Is that going to be the Department of Revenue? Really, this is what the free market's about. So I agree with the testifier in opposition to this and don't think it's a good path to go down.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Carlson. Can I just add one thing so that there's clarity here? The online travel company or the tour group never sets the rate for the room. That is always set by the hotelier. And they make that available on the platform to what they are willing to sell that room for. And the full tax that is due on the rate that the hotelier sets is collected and paid. So there's this misconception that somehow travel companies buy up a block of rooms and then resell it at a lower rate. That does not happen. So what the hotelier sets the rate on the room, the full lodging tax is collected and paid on what the hotelier sets. So that's an excellent point, and I appreciate you bringing it up.
Thank you, Representative Hertas.
Thank you, and I think that reinforces my point. Without that online service, that discounted room isn't going to be sold, and so that's revenue that's lost. And so everybody thinks it's a loophole in terms of losing revenue, but these online agencies are actually selling more rooms that probably would not otherwise happen. The example I use is a good example because not only do you have a legal jurisdiction in terms of a city, very close proximity to where you want to go, but you also have a state line. And so I can book a room in Arlington versus in D.C. I can choose. I've got a whole bunch of choices, and those choices greatly influence my decision. And, you know, whether or not you want to be 15 miles further away and save $200 a night, that clearly would be the solution. So I would say that a city like Bloomington probably gets more sales tax revenue by having the online services selling those rooms at a discount rather than going somewhere else.
Thank you. Before we, and I know Representative Frankie's got a question and others may too, but let's have Mr. Cummings come up and give us a little context here from the department's point of view. Good morning, Mr. Cummings, and your name is not Carlson.
Yes. For the record, Mr. Chair and members, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Mr. Chair, the Department of Revenue supports this bill, which clarifies that local lodging taxes apply to the whole price of lodging, including any of the accommodation intermediary provided by accommodation intermediaries. This proposal is also included in the Department of Revenue's technical bill. This has been part of our technical bill package since 2015. I think there was some testimony to say that this has been part of our package since 2012, and that's just not correct. There has not been an omnibus tax bill since this was proposed in 2015. And, Mr. Chair, we are hopeful that this year this can be clarified. Accommodations intermediaries are online lodging and travel providers who resell rooms. The proposal conforms to the definition used for the state sales tax and local lodging taxes currently collected by the state. One of the questions that was brought up was, would the Department of Revenue be setting the sales price or deciding what the sales price is? Absolutely not, Mr. Chair. The consumer would be. This is based on the market, so it would whatever the consumer pays as the sales price for that room would be the price that would have the local lodging tax be collected on, not another price that is somewhere that is not disclosed to the consumer, that is somewhere in between zero and the sales price paid by the consumer. It would be paid by the sales price by the consumer, just like any other sales tax. This proposal makes it clear that local lodging taxes apply to the sales price of lodging, regardless if it was sold by the hotel or an accommodations intermediary. For instance, if you bought a book from a store and the store argued that the sales price for the purposes of some of their sales tax should be the wholesale price paid by the retailer and not the retail sales price paid by the consumer, that would be incredibly inconsistent with how we treat sales price. We can't say that the wholesale sales price is the price and then the cost of stocking and reselling the book at retail is a service provided to the consumer that is different than sales price as a service. I think, Mr. Chair, that would be an incredibly different precedent, and that would be setting a precedent for the future that I'm not sure that we would be interested in. And I'm just trying to this is not about more or less tax. This is about ensuring that we have consistent tax bases. If this committee wants to think about tax rates or the amount levied, then that's a different and important conversation that I know that we've talked about at length, Mr. Chair, but this is about ensuring consistent tax breaks bases. Mr. Chair, this provides a disproportionate advantage to out-of-state accommodation intermediaries that is not provided if a consumer were to call a hotel or were to use a hotel website. And so that is an important consideration to think about as well. And I know, Mr. Chair, that in our conversations related to tax policy for some of the online companies that market various products, they do have sophisticated tax softwares that will allow them to collect and remit the dozens and dozens of types of different tax rates that are all across the state that deal with local lodging tax or that deal with local sales tax. Mr. Chair, in determining whether to apply the tax to local to lodging related services, it should be not matter who administers a local lodging tax, the local government or the Department of Revenue, nor should it matter whether the local lodging tax is authorized under general or special law. It is important that taxes, when authorized, are generally applied fairly and consistently across the state, and that is not the case right now, Mr. Chair. If this bill moves through the process, the Department of Revenue looks forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, and we appreciate the opportunity to be a resource.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Mr. Cummings, could you give kind of just a nuts and bolts ABC for the committee about the difference between the collection of the tax by local units of government and the state and what happens and how their practices are different?
I can, Mr. Chair. I also see Ms. Dalton ready. So maybe Ms. Dalton could do that.
Should we draw for a donut? Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, all the local governments that impose a local lodging tax have the option of allowing the state to collect the tax for them. However, then they must pay a fee to the Department of Revenue for that collection. Often, particularly in very small jurisdictions, the amount of lodging tax collected does not really make that economically feasible for them. Having said that, there are four lodging taxes that are currently collected by the state. Those four are Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, and the Bowabic area lodging taxes. In those cases, state statute requires that the same tax base used for definition of lodging for the sales tax purposes be used for the collection of their lodging. So for those four cities, we're already imposing their local lodging tax on travel intermediaries.
And for the rest, we are not, Ms.
And for the rest, they are collecting their taxes locally, and so they are not subject to what's in the state statute.
Thank you. Questions for Ms. Dalton on that? Representative Anderson, and then to that point, anyway. Would you?
Not on that, no.
Okay. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Ms. Dalton, as I understand, on the local level, county, city, do all hotels in the area have to collect the sales tax, or are there ones that don't, and is that tax uniform throughout that whole taxing area, or is it kind of a wide-open horse race?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there is a statute 469.190, which is what this is amending, that basically allows counties, a city, a township, or a consortium, I mean a joint, under a joint powers, to impose a lodging tax. It's consistent within the area of the group that imposes it. However, if I'm understanding there's actually a resort in one area of the state that is refusing to collect their local lodging tax. In that case, it's actually up to the city to enforce the collection. The state would not get involved in that enforcement duty.
Representative Anderson?
Thanks again, Mr. Chair. So to clarify, if the city decides to impose a sales tax, the township just right outside the city that may have a nice resort, they would not have to follow suit with the city. Is that correct?
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that is correct. It is strictly up to the local governments to decide whether they are going to impose it, and then also whether they are imposing it under joint powers or under their individual authority.
So the township and the city could get together, and the township could have the city collect it from their jurisdiction. Is that what you're saying, Ms. Dalton?
Mr. Chair, that is correct. The county can also choose to impose it on unorganized territory within the county. So the county has that authority as well.
Thank you. Representative Hertas on this point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So what you just described with regard to these four regions, in that scenario, the state is acting as an agent to collect the revenue. And the state, according to your description, doesn't want the headache of having a myriad of different manners in which this tax is collected. So there's continuity in terms of how you collect the tax. So I think that's the argument when the online providers are the agent who's collecting the money. You create not only differences within this state, but and not just by county, but by city and by all across the nation, it really would be a nightmare. So the very argument that I think you've kind of stated, the way the state has continuity, is the very reason we heard testimony from the online providers and what a headache it would be to collect that tax and try to know what every jurisdiction is.
I don't know if there's not a question, but
Well, I think the question is the state is acting as an agent, just like the online provider is, mm-hmm. in collecting the fee of the money.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hertas, that is not correct. We are not online, the state is not online travel booking companies. We are not providing any sort of way to deliver hotel rooms to consumers, charging consumers a sales tax or a local lodging tax. That is not our role for the local lodging tax. At some point, there is the person who collects all of the taxes that come in, whether it is a local sales tax, whether it is a local lodging tax, and then that is distributed back in order to the local units of government. So to say that we are equivalent to a Travelocity is absolutely not correct. And I would just want to reiterate that the sales price is the sales price is the sales price for consumers. So the sales price is not different for a consumer if it goes to Travelocity or whether it goes to, Hilton.com. They are, sales price is the same for the consumers. In one of those instances, there are advocates saying that the local lodging tax should not be based on the sales price that are paid by the consumers. That has nothing to do with who is the actual agent for collecting the tax and remitting it back to the city. That is a completely different conversation. So I just wanted to clarify the record that the Department of Revenue is in no way an online travel intermediary.
So, Mr. Cummings, how much does the Department of Revenue charge those four cities for the service?
I will check and get back to you, Mr. Chair. It is a it's a very small amount that that just ensures that we are covering the costs of making sure that we can collect that tax just as a local sales tax, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. Representative Hertas.
Mr. Cummings, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummings, those are your words. Those are your characterization of what I said. That's not what I was saying. I never implied that you're the booking agent. I said you have established an agency relationship with that community who chooses to let you be the agent for them in collecting the tax. That's not what I said about booking it. No, I'm not saying that the state is the agent in terms of booking. I said you are acting as you've established an agency relationship with that city or that county in which you're collecting the tax. And so my point was is that you want uniformity on how you collect that, okay? And it makes it easy and streamlined for you to be able to remit the tax. What my point was is that those online booking agencies are asking for the same consideration. They want streamlined process, and it's really, how many cities are in the nation? I have no idea. But we're talking tens of thousands of communities in which local tax rates would be different, and you're asking them to know each and every applicable rate, whether it's a local option tax, city tax, state tax. You're asking them to figure that out. And really, by alleviating them from that burden, then the local provider of the service is responsible for paying that tax. That was my point. So please don't mischaracterize that I'm calling the state of Minnesota Travelocity. That's not my point.
Mr. Chair.
They still are too big, though, Mr. Cummings. Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, I would love to have, you know, Travelocity does a very good job in terms of providing service, so I don't mean to say that at all. We try and provide. I will just say, Mr. Chair, very quickly that one of a large national firm did call the services that we provide on our sales tax for our website, Mr. Chair, the best in the country. So I will take that. I'll just take this opportunity to say that. But I wanted to say, Mr. Chair, that I think this is a matter of fairness. It's a matter of fairness for our cities. It's a matter of fairness for Minnesota's consumers as they enter the marketplace, that they would be treated fairly under the law. And it is a matter of ensuring that the sales price is equitable for our local lodging tax and our local sales tax. You know, I've heard a lot of arguments about what types of taxes are most beneficial to our state. You know, some say sales tax, some say income tax, and others. But as we try and ensure that we're talking about which tax rates to have or which credits to impose, when these issues come up that ensure that there is consistency amongst the sales tax, these are things that we need to think about and we need to correct. Because this isn't a matter of who should pay more and who should pay less. This is a matter of ensuring that all taxpayers are treated fairly under the rates and bases that are decided by the legislature. End with that, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. It seems, I think, at least I find it compelling that we've got two different systems or two different bases here that begs for some sort of uniformity. Is another way to fix it to amend the approach that the state uses to match what local governments do in their collection. Is that another way to fix this?
Well, Mr. Chair, to say that there would be some retail sales type of taxes that would be based on the wholesale sales price and to ensure that local hotels would have a competitive disadvantage to large out-of-state, accommodations intermediaries is something that would provide consistency, Mr. Chair, but I'm not sure that that would provide the best policy and the best precedent related to our sales tax. Again, Mr. Chair, if we were going to say that we were going to charge a sales tax, if you walked into a neighborhood bookstore on the wholesale price of a book, and then you wouldn't have to pay the price based on the amount that they have for wages and restocking and selling and, you know, the types of things that services that bookstores provide, that would be something that, you know, that would be a consistency that I don't think would be very helpful. It also probably wouldn't be something that Streamline would like very much, but I'm using that as an example.
Thank you. Representative Frankie.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Cummings, I don't know if you can answer this question, but actually I have two, Mr. Chair. The first one is when you talked about precedents, and are we opening ourselves up to additional taxes in other areas? I understand this is all about lodging tax, but when we talk about the Internet, I mean, I'm thinking about things like our third-party online ticket sales and things like that. There's a lot of fees and service charges and things like that from companies that are with outside of our state. And now since, you know, scalping, easy way to say it, is allowed in this state, the price versus the value versus the wholesale is so out of whack and out of range on things like that. Is the state currently capturing revenue from the value of those tickets and other Internet sales that are within those third parties outside of the state?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frankie, first of all, I am your constituent. I live in South St. Paul. I'm a proud resident of South St. Paul, so I haven't met you, but it's great to meet you.
Then you must not have been home, Mr. Cummings, because I thought out every door.
Always an erring comment.
So, Representative Frankie, you know, I think I'm going to defer the specific question about ticket reselling to Ms. Dalton, but when we talk about the various types of how things are treated digitally and how things, what happens online or what types, what goes on with things, you know, like resellers like eBay and other things, these are questions that we deal with all the time on Tax Committee. I will tell you that this bill is specific and very limited to the issue that we're talking about today, dealing with local lodging taxes that are administered locally. So it doesn't deal with the other types of larger issues that the change in the economy towards the Internet would provide. This is a very narrowly drafted bill. But I think Ms. Dalton could maybe provide some context about the many discussions over the years as she's been right in the middle of them.
Ms. Dalton, do you have something to add to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Frankie, ticket reselling is actually a somewhat complicated issue in sales taxes. There have been some changes in the law recently, basically to avoid some double taxation. So when, like, Ticket King or one of those places is reselling a ticket, the sales tax paid is the sales tax on the price of the ticket at the resale level minus the price of the ticket when it was originally purchased, because there was already sales tax paid on that. So there's been some work on that. How the fees fit in, I would actually have to go back and take a look at that.
Right. And I think this is just, sorry to interrupt, getting a little bit off topic, but just the fact that there's so many other things that could be clarified and lumped into and possibly setting a precedent here. I'll just get to my second question, Mr. Chair. Now, Representative Carlson, could you tell me, and maybe you don't know, or one of your testifiers knows, a lot of these online companies, now you can just book and you don't have to pay till you check out. So is that fee or tax paid on checking out, or are we talking about just the payments that are made online?
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Frankie, I'm going to have Mr. Runling come up here again and kind of bring this all home for us, because I think your question is spot on in terms of an example of how this could work. And but I guess I'll end by saying, or preface the answer to your question by saying, what we're trying to do here is to treat this, to create a fix that will allow for, which currently the online travel companies are paying at a wholesale rate versus the retail rate, and we're looking to rectify that. So that's at the basis of what this bill is about, and we heard testimony so far to that effect. How this plays out in terms of your example, Shane, any insights on that?
Mr. Rudland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So customer goes to a website and sees $100. That's what they see. They're going to pay tax on either $100 or call it the wholesale price. Pretend the wholesale price is $80 as in the handout that we handed out. So they pay $100 for the hotel room, and they don't see what's happening behind the scenes at all. And the Travelocity website will list the tax already based on the wholesale price on their website. So they already know what the tax rates are in all the cities. They have all that technology. It exists today. You can do it on any laptop or personal computer, whatever, today. So they already have all the information about what all the taxes are. The thing is they're applying it to the $80, not the $100. So this argument about technology being too complicated is non-existent because it's already happening today. They're just applying the tax when they calculate the final bill for you on the $80, not the $100. You go to the Marriott.com website, they'll apply the taxes on the $100. And so there is no technological issue. There's no confusion. In fact, the sales tax itself, so we're talking, we've got lodging tax and sales tax and sometimes other taxes in various jurisdictions. The sales tax is applied to the $100. So it's even more complicated than that, but that's already happening. There is no technological issue that needs to be fixed. It's just numbers that need to be changed so that they apply it to the correct number. Straight up sales tax is happening on the 100, not on the 80 today. So there's no technical issue. This is simply a lodging tax base. And I think Mr. Cummings laid out a great example as a book. You go in and you pay $20 for a book. If the bookstore was smart and the tax base was different, they could say, well, the book is $5, but our service fee is $15, therefore the tax should be only on the $5. Now, if you look at that, it's crazy, right? I mean, we're not going to start paying for things like that. I mean, companies would distort themselves to make your car only worth $5, and the service fee on top of that car is, you know, the rest of the money on the car. So that's crazy when you put it into that example. I think it really illustrates the point really well. And this technology issue is a non-existent issue because it's happening today.
So, Mr. Rudland, you're saying that it's being applied differently company by company.
Mr. Chair, members, that's correct. The if you go on the Expedia website today and try to book a room in Bloomington, I've done this many times, and you get all the way to the end before, you know, I haven't bought the room because I don't want to book the room, but you get all the way to the end and look at the tax number. It's there. It exists. So a $179 a night hotel room at Radisson Blue, for example, is the one I do often. You get a different tax number than if you go on the Radisson Blue website and go all the way to the end for the same $179 hotel room. The dollar amount for the room doesn't change. The hotels and the travel companies have come to an agreement that the number for the hotel room is going to be consistent. You will not get a cheaper room going on Expedia or Marriott. You will just pay a different tax depending on which one you end up clicking. They already know what the tax rates are. They just apply it to the wholesale price on certain portions of the tax. And depending on who collects it, there's another nuance here that is an important detail that we've talked a little bit about, is that who collects the tax, the Department of Revenue. The statute currently is more clear that if the Department of Revenue collects the tax, the travel companies have to pay it. And there's a lawsuit that was just settled that clarified that. Versus if the locals collect the tax, you may not have to pay it. And that's one of the things that we'd like to be clarified. So the fact that who does the tax collecting, either the DOR or the local agency, is another nuance in this bill that just, I think, highlights the inconsistent tax policy that exists today that we're trying to rectify.
Thank you. Representative Frankie, you good to go?
I'm good.
Thank you. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Dalton, I just want to make sure I understand, because we have a lot of things been thrown out here. So the four municipalities, Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, and the Bowabic area, the state collects the tax. And when you collect it, you collect from the OTCs the entire amount. Now, I'm not sure, and I don't know if you can have this number at the top of your head, but I'd hazard to guess that those four jurisdictions probably have a pretty big share of the state market when it comes to wholesale taxes on, accommodations. Would that be correct? Are they 20% of the market? I know. I was asking a question that was like.
Ms. Dalton.
Mr. Chair, Representative Joaquin. No, I don't know what percentage of the lodging market is in those four cities. I am guessing that Bloomington also represents a significant share, and also the city of Duluth. One of the things that's in this bill is some language that says this shouldn't be used to decide what the law was in previously, and that's because under Duluth's lodging tax and how they defined lodging for their ordinance, for their local lodging tax, they've actually gone, you know, they've tried to impose this on their intermediaries already. I believe there was going to be a court case. I don't know what happened to that court case. So there is not necessarily even consistency in how these travel intermediaries are treated under local lodging taxes now, even if they are not being collected by the state.
Thank you, Ms. Dalton. I only ask because I think uniformity is really important. And I, you know, just by judging by the population of those cities and the amount of tourism they get, I would hazard a guess that it is a, you know, a rather large chunk. And while the chair made a good point of, like, why not have them adjust to the other end, which is why don't we have the OTCs then not pay that tax the same way the state collects it, since it sounds like each of the other municipalities are so different, that to get that uniformity, we would rather really go towards Minneapolis, St. Paul, Rochester, and how the state collects it. Just a thought.
Thank you. Members, we are crunching time here, so we got two on the list here, Hertas and Nelson. We'll ask you both to be very brief. Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we're listening about what it's like to be in business, and there's been some misrepresentations about it. The bookstore analogy, the online company doesn't own the book. The bookstore owns the book. They bought the book, and they mark up the book to have a retail profit. That margin that they mark the book up is what's taxed. So that's not a fair comparison to say that an online agent owns that property. They don't. They're an agent. It's just like when they sell a room. They don't own the hotel. They don't sell the room in terms of their owning the room. The hotel owns the room. They sell the room, and they have a direct cost of what it costs to produce that room, and then they mark it up, and that's the retail price, and that's what the tax has been on, is being applied to, is the retail price. Representative Frankie raises a good point. What other things are this going to be on? In the 88th legislature, we had the proposals for the business-to-business tax, that CPA's services are going to be taxable, that attorney's fees are going to be taxable. Then it even, you know, you wonder about whether or not real estate fees should be taxable. None of these agents in the, doing the services for other business own the product. It's an agency relationship. And certainly within housing, as an example, labor is not taxed if it's so broken out as such, but the materials that go into the house are. And the real estate agent doesn't own the house. They're acting just as that, as an agent assisting in the sale, but they do not own the house, and they're not the one that should be paying the retail tax, other than what the cost of the house is.
Thank you. Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I got a different question here that what I thought I heard Mr. Carlson, Joel, say about there's some confusion about, I think I heard him say that there might be a tax liability going backwards so many years on this. And I guess I want a clarification on this. If this bill were to pass and be part of it, our tax bill going forward, are we incurring a liability to hotels or these companies going backwards, or is this going to start when it passes going forward? I mean, I think I heard Mr. Carlson say that this would create a liability going backwards, and I guess I want clarification on
Mr.
that.
Mr. Carlson, can you give a review of that again? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Joel Carlson for your tape. Representative Nelson, in other jurisdictions, local units of government have litigated with online companies to claim back taxes when they have clarified this is what was due. This doesn't say it's due back to the when the bill was first introduced in 2010 or 2015, but you're certainly creating a potential retroactive liability by saying this has been the law all along and you just haven't been paying it. And there's been a lot of discussion here and misperceptions about what's really going on. And, well, I don't like the numbers because they're not accurate. Let's just use the $100 room rate and the $20 accommodation fee, which is not accurate, but we'll use that for an example. What the legislature did in 2011 is they placed a sales tax on the $20. And that's what we pay the sales tax on. And that's what we're paying today. And we didn't challenge that. It took us a year to write a revenue notice of how this would actually be collected by these travel intermediaries. But you never amended the local lodging tax. And it's our position, and always has been our position, even in those four jurisdictions, that the local lodging tax was never amended. You put a sales tax on this service. You did not amend local lodging tax. We pay the sales tax, the full tax, on the accommodation fee, whatever it is. It's not 20, but whatever it is. There is no variable rate. Nobody pays a different rate based on what you book. The lodging tax is the lodging tax. It's paid by the accommodation provider, which is a new term that you put in statute at the same time you put in the tax on travel intermediaries. That full tax is paid by them on the full rate that they charge for the room, and the legislature put a sales tax on the service fee for travel intermediaries, and that's what we pay. But you never amended local lodging tax. You're not clarifying it because you never did it. And if you come back and do that, it's my position that you're exposing companies to retroactive tax liability by saying this was our intent all along. Happy to answer other questions, Mr. Chairman.
So thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I don't see that in the bill, but I guess maybe point four, we can get some clarification on that. But I thought I heard him say that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Representative Carlson, any departing comments here before we move forward?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Just in closing, House File 427 simply clarifies that no matter how you book a hotel room, either through an official website, by phone, or through an OTC, the amount of tax you pay should be the same. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. And with that, Representative Nelson renews his motion that House File 427 be laid over for possible inclusion. And with that, House File 427 is laid over. Representative Sundin, welcome to the committee. We are looking at House File 514. Is there a motion to move House File 514? Representative Loeffler moves House File 514 be entertained by the committee and then laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. There's also an amendment just to clean it up, a technical amendment.
Let's put the amendment on right away, Representative Sundin. Representative Loeffler moves the A1 amendment. Representative Sundin, describe the amendment quickly.
It's just a technical fix to clean up the language and update it.
Okay. Members, any discussion on the A1 amendment as presented? Seeing none, all in favor of adopting the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The amendment is adopted. Representative Sundin.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee. House File 514 seeks exemption for a new clinic in the city of Duluth. The clinic is owned and operated by the Fond du Lac Band of Ojibwe, and it's a positive addition to the health care community in the city of Duluth. And we're seeking that exemption for the property taxes, and I have with me today Reed LeBeau to explain any details or answer questions regarding the bill.
Thank you. Mr. LeBeau, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Reed LeBeau on behalf of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa. I also want to thank Representative Rarick for co-authoring this bill with Representative Sundin. This is a clinic facility that the band is operating to provide free services for members, also services to employees of the band. This is basically almost a mirror image of a bill that this legislature passed about 4 years ago for a government-owned property on Franklin Avenue in downtown Minneapolis. That's what we've used as the template for what we're attempting to do here. The long and short, Mr. Chairman, members, is that if it was a nonprofit owning a clinic, it would be exempt. If it was a tribal government facility, it would arguably be exempt under that other statute that we passed. But because this is both, the statute isn't clear that it applies in this case, so that's why we're asking for this very limited exemption. We're not, you can see from the language, we're not trying to make this apply to every tribal facility on fee land, just one that's operated as a medical clinic. This is an expansion that the band is doing. Sadly, there's been an increase throughout the state in chemical dependency issues, and that's one of the things that this clinic is going to primarily focus on.
Mr. LeBeau, why does the bill, the exemption expire in 2028?
Mr. Chairman, members, that is it's language that first came on. Those sunsets were put into exemptions, I think, about 4 or 5 years ago. That was similar to what happened with the MCT, the Minnesota Chippewa Tribe property tax exemption. I believe it was the chairman, both the House and Senate chairman's desire at that point in time that all exemptions be reviewed on a certain basis, so we've left it in.
Thank you. Anyone else that would like to testify in favor or opposed to House File 514? Hearing none, members, any questions, comments on the bill? Okay. Representative Sundin, any final comments?
No, just to reiterate, this is a very, very positive influence on the healthcare community in the city of Duluth, and serves the native tribes well. Thanks.
Thank you. With that, Representative Loeffler renews her motion that House File 514 be laid over for possible inclusion. All in favor, or actually we don't vote on that. House File 514 is laid over for possible inclusion. Thank you both. Representative Yulicki.
I didn't know if you were
going to
have Mr.
Senator Sundin, who is otherwise.
No.
Well, House File 414. Mm-hmm. Okay, Representative Joaquin moves her own bill. Representative Joaquin moves House File 414 to be laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for hearing this bill today. I actually have an author's amendment to put the bill in its proper shape, and I want to thank Mr. Hines for catching. It was basically a technical correction when it was redrafted. Again, I had introduced this 2 years ago, and we just had to change some dates. So I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Thank you. Representative Joaquin moves the A1 amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, all in favor of approving the A1 amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Motion passes. The A1 is adopted. Representative Joaquin.
Thank you so much. Many of you may be familiar with a tax incentive program called This Old House. That was phased out for new applications in 2003. This bill brings that program back and includes a similar incentive tool for owner-occupied commercial, for commercial and industrial buildings. Before being elected to the House, I served on the Hopkins City Council for 9 years. Hopkins is a small town about 2 by 2 miles just west of Minneapolis. We are unique that we have still have a traditional old Main Street with old commercial buildings, and while our housing stock includes only about 43% of single-family homes. A large percentage of those homes are older. Maintaining our housing stock is one of the highlights of our comprehensive plan, and keeping our vitality of our Main Street alive is one of the others. So this bill would actually help both. Our residents continually struggle to find ways to maintain and improve the homes that they live in to fit in their pocketbooks. A program like this old house would give them an incentive, or remove a disincentive, to fix up their older homes without immediately worrying about the burden of the increased taxes offsetting the benefit of their improvements. I've also quite frequently heard from business owners along Main Street that they would like to improve their properties, but worry about seeing that exact amount of their improvement show up as an increased assessment on their property. They want to make the improvements, but just need a little bit of help. While some cities have the money to be able to run grant programs as a way to encourage businesses to upgrade, not all cities do. And a program like this old shop would help those small business owners make valuable investments in their properties. As for the details of the bill, it allows homes under $400,000 in value that make at least $5,000 assessed improvement to their home to deduct that increase from their assessed amount before taxes are calculated. The house has to be at least 30 years old. You cannot raise more than 50% of the structure, and you cannot double it in size. For a commercial industrial building that is over 30 years old, there has to be an assessed value of under $2 million. The improvement has to add at least 12% onto the market value, and the same 50-cent rule applies. I've heard from some that they're worried that the exclusion of portions of property in a jurisdiction shifts taxes to other properties within that same jurisdiction. And I can understand that concern. But for those of you that live in smaller towns, like Hopkins, towns that are all over Minnesota, you understand the symbiotic relationship between the housing market and the Main Street, and the Main Street district and the housing market. When one does well, the other does well as well, too. So I think it's important to understand that this program was originally designed to provide homeowners of older homes and businesses with an additional incentive and take away disincentive to renovate their property, and in turn, preserve and revitalize our older neighborhoods and Main Streets. It's also important to note that the housing portion of this old house program was in place from 1994 to 2003, so assessors in the Department of Revenue have successfully implemented it before. In fact, 86 out of the 87 counties across the state had homeowners that utilized this program. Now, that all being said, I am not wedded to this specific approach. I am open to and value any discussions or suggestions that leads to some sort of program that would achieve the same goals. Our communities need programs like this to keep their economies vital and strong. In your packet, you're going to find a brief one-page description of the program, along with a chart that kind of gives some examples of what this would look like for a commercial business, since this is a new part of the program. And there's also a portion of a 2004 report that Minnesota Department of Revenue did on how the program was utilized across the whole entire state. And I'm sorry, but there was a last-minute inclusion. I have a constituent who, the minute I introduced this bill 2 years ago, wrote me right away saying, oh, I've been waiting for this to come back into effect. We've been in our home for decades. We want to age in place. We need improvements. We can't afford them. We are actually going to wait until this bill passes before we do something. And she was so excited to hear. I was introducing it again. I ran into her a few weeks ago. So when we got put on the docket, I asked if she wanted to make some comments. So thank you for letting me hand that out so you could see what she had to say. I have a few people here today explain the program benefits. I have Charlie Van Darty here from Metro Cities. And then also in the audience, either Gary Carlson or Heather Cochran from League of Minnesota Cities. And then also Aaron Hannafinberg from the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota and the Minnesota Main Street Program to speak about the benefits. So I would like to kick it off to Mr. Van Darty.
Thank you, Brooke. Mr. Van Darty, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Charlie Van Darty, and I represent Metro Cities, an association of 90 member cities across the 7-county metro area. Metro Cities appreciates the opportunity to testify in support of House File 414, which reauthorizes this old house and creates this old shop program. Community reinvestment is a topic of great interest to cities. Last year, Metro Cities hosted a one-day session on a range of housing issues, and one of the most talked-about topics, the area that drew a lot of interest, was housing, preservation, and investment. Homeowners have called City Halls asking if there were programs or funds to help them with making modest improvements to their homes. Not every city has funds or resources to partner with homeowners, which is why this bill meets a big unmet need. When this old house was previously authorized, homeowners from across the metro and across the state capitalized on the program, using the tax benefit to help them finance their investments. Metro City supports this bill because cities have an interest in maintaining and preserving housing stock in their communities, ensuring quality homes for generations of residents to live. Reinvestment prevents neighborhoods from falling into disrepair, revitalizes communities, and protects the city's tax base. For homeowners, this old house offers a strategy to protect their investment. This can mean making needed exterior repairs or decreasing their energy costs by increasing energy efficiencies. Other types of improvements, including livability and accessibility updates for seniors, would allow Minnesotans to age in place, staying connected to their family and community. On Main Street, this old shop helps shop owners make improvements to their businesses. Metro Cities has heard stories about businesses hesitating to make improvements, unsure about the return on their investment. By deferring the increased tax assessment, this bill provides an incentive to spur these small businesses to reinvest in their businesses, reinvest in their communities, and spur additional reinvestment up and down Main Streets. Metro Cities encourages the committee to support this old house and this old shop, and thank you for your time and consideration today.
Thank you, Mr. Vanderardi. We have Ms. Hannafin Berg here.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Erin Hannafin Berg. I serve as the Director of Preservation Support Services at the Preservation Alliance of Minnesota. The Preservation Alliance is a nonprofit statewide organization with a mission to lead and inspire people to connect to historic places, promoting community vitality. I'm here on behalf of this organization and as a member of the Building Jobs Coalition to express our support for HF414, This Old House, This Old Shop. At the Preservation Alliance, we love old buildings, not just because they look cool, but because of what people do in, with, and to them. It doesn't surprise us in the least that some of our state's most economically vibrant areas are the ones with a variety of old buildings that have been successfully rehabilitated. But many of our communities need an extra nudge, and that's where we think this old house, this old shop, could be of benefit. Two of the Preservation Alliance's core programs are education and Minnesota Main Street. Through our education classes, we're helping do-it-yourselfers invest in their properties and in their communities by teaching them how to fix their old windows, refinish their wood floors, and repair and patch plaster. Our Main Street program is an affiliate of the Main Street America program and uses a tried-and-true approach that has been leading in design, economic development, promotion, and organizational development in historic downtowns for over 35 years. Main Street's primary assets are their people and their heritage. Historic downtowns provide a natural incubator for local entrepreneurs, and these businesses are central to local economic vitality and stability. In Minnesota, we have 7 designated Main Street communities: Wilmer, Red Wing, Owatonna, Shakopee, Winona, Faribault, and New Ulm. There are additional 30 associate communities throughout the state of Minnesota. Since 2010, when Main Street was reestablished in Minnesota, we've collected data from the 7 designated communities. And in this time, we've seen that building owners have completed 321 building rehabilitation projects, which represent nearly $33 million in private and public investment. There have been 91 new businesses created in these 7 communities, and 386 new jobs that have been developed in these historic downtowns. Also in 2010, which was a banner year for preservation in Minnesota, I have to say, because of the passage of the Minnesota Historic Rehabilitation Tax Credit, we've seen that there have been thousands of people employed and hundreds of millions of dollars invested in the rehabilitation of historic buildings that are listed in the National Register of Historic Places and that are used for commercial purposes. Also, for every dollar of the state tax credit, there's approximately $9 that have been generated in additional economic activity for the state. So this program more than pays for itself. Rehabilitating older buildings tends to be a more labor-intensive practice than new construction. Nearly 70% of project budgets for preservation are dedicated to labor, while new construction has about a 50-50 labor and materials ratio. Increased labor results in greater personal and business income, and it also generates more sales tax revenues. We've seen great success in the historic tax credit over the years, and we hope that it will continue to incentivize rehabilitation and activity in Minnesota for many years to come. But it leaves out most of those other people that we're trying to help, the old house and small commercial property owners. When these places are renovated, they provide the same economic and community benefits that we see from the historic tax credit, but they typically don't qualify for those credits. The historic tax credit is only available to properties that are listed in the National Register, but there are fewer than 30 historic designated downtowns in Minnesota. In fact, most of the buildings in Red Wing, Wilmer, and Shakopee would not qualify for the historic rehabilitation tax credit because they're not within designated commercial historic districts. Homestead, a residential property, is not eligible for this credit, and the vast majority of houses in Minnesota do not meet the criteria for listing in the National Register. Even in some place like downtown Winona, which is a historic district, property owners could use some help for their buildings to contribute fully to the economic vitality of their downtown. Dennis McIntaffer has opened a successful frozen yogurt and ice cream parlor in a building he purchased in downtown Winona. The ground floor has been beautifully renovated, and he even has a space in the basement to host kids' birthday parties. But his dreams of converting the upper stories into 10 two-bedroom apartments are on hold for now. This is just one example of how this old house, this old shop, could be used to incentivize building maintenance and rehabilitation in our great historic downtowns throughout the state. In short, rehabilitating old buildings is a powerful act of development that creates jobs and income. Because of the labor intensity of rehabilitation and the relatively high wages for workers, very few industries create more jobs and household income than preservation does. For the Preservation Alliance and the Building Jobs Coalition, we urge you to support this bill that will aid in the rehab development of our existing buildings to keep the cores of our communities strong. We're eager to serve as a resource to you, so I encourage you to ask questions or let us provide more information if you need that. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Hannafin-Berg. By the way, our family shoe store, Baker Shoes, is about four buildings down from the yogurt shop in Winona. So,
that's great.
Thank you. We'll proceed with the other testifiers and then maybe ask for questions from folks. Mr. Carlson, or actually we have someone else.
Mr. Chair, I am not a Carlson. I'll give you a break from that for today.
Thank you.
For us to stay. My name is Heather Corcoran. I'm the Intergovernmental Relations Member Relations Coordinator at the League of Minnesota Cities. The League is a statewide association. For those of you who aren't familiar with us yet, we have 833 of the 853 cities around the state. We support this bill and have worked with Representative Joachim when she was a council member and when she's been a representative. We hear often, as Mr. Vander already said, from cities all around the state, both large and small, that are looking for tools to offer their residents and their small business owners to maintain housing stock and revitalize their downtowns. We think that this bill would do just that and offer a good tool to those communities. When we were before this committee in 2015, we had folks from cities around the state, such as Lake City, Hopkins, Wilmer, and Faribault, speak in support of the bill. They weren't able to come on a little bit of late notice, and so, but they have supported it in the past. In one of your handouts, you'll see that Department of Revenue report part of it, and in there you'll see that 57,000 properties use the program in all but one county in the state. So it's very wide-ranging. It has it's something that cities are familiar with and that residents are as well. We had a task force, the League did, back in 2013. I was looking back at my notes, and at that time, we asked community development directors from cities around the state what they would do to improve the program as it was originally existed, and that's where we got the idea to kind of change the eligibility criteria for the years, moving it from the 45 to the 30 that you see in front of you today, so to try to get at some of those properties that now would be up for, you know, a new roof or some other improvement. So that's why you see the change you do there. The League supports this bill, hopes you consider it, and looks forward to the discussion on how we can provide more tools to homeowners and small businesses around the state. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Corcoran. Mr. May. Welcome, Mr. May.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom May. I'm the retired Hennepin County Assessor, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. MAO opposes this bill. We've been here before, as the history would show. Each year we prepare a position statement for the legislative session. Thanks to staff, I believe you have a copy of that, And I'd just like to read a couple points that we have in that position statement. Under item two, MAO supports the principle of ad valorem taxation, which is taxation based on market value. MAO believes adjustments to market values, such as limitation on assessors' estimated market values, acquisition values, deferments, exclusions, or exemption, creates inequities between taxpayers. MAO supports good tax policy that treats all taxpayers in a consistent manner. MAO opposes classifications of programs that target only a small number of taxpayers. MAO encourages the continued use of state-administered programs such as the property tax refund program, special targeting refunds, the income tax system, etc., if policymakers wish to grant additional tax relief. In other words, if a concept like this is approved, it should be approved through a state program, not put into the property tax system. In an ad valorem system like we have in Minnesota, exclusions like this do shift the tax burden. In this case, they shift the tax burden from those taxpayers who make improvements onto those taxpayers who don't make improvements or can't afford those improvements. There is a history included in the packet. The Department of Revenue also tracked the original This Old House statute that started in 1993 and, of course, ended in 2003. And just to show that it's not a small program, in 2003, there was over $700 million of excluded value in the state of Minnesota and 59,289 properties that were being administrated by assessors across the state. In 2010, the legislature approved the nonpartisan property tax working group. And in 2011 through 2012, they studied the property tax system and made several recommendations. Their report was dated November 30th of 2012, and in that report, they had certain guiding principles that I think apply directly to proposals like This Old House. One of the guiding principles was base property taxes on market value, in other words, a true ad valorem system, using a value other than the full estimated market value by applying exclusions, limitations, or alternate values creates confusion, complexity, costs, and distortions in the system. One of the other guiding principles was to make simplicity and transparency a priority. A transparent and understandable system facilitates trust and accountability. A simple system is more efficient and reduces errors, unintended outcomes, and high costs. Policymakers must defend these important principles. Within this report, there were 19 recommendations made about our property tax system. If we look at those, there were two that were specifically recommendations that dealt with exclusions and deferrals and special valuations. Recommendation 14, the state should not use exclusions to avoid paying for benefits that things are important. 18, special valuations and deferrals. These programs increase complexity and decrease efficiency, transparency, and accountability. Their recommendation was impose sunset dates on all current future programs to prompt review. And if you look at the recommendations in the report, the specific recommendations, and they have one for This Old House and This Old Business, is allow those programs to phase out. And the reasons they had it, they did not necessarily achieve intended goals, and they're not transparent. Also, in addition, the IAAO, which is the International Association of Assessing Offices, in their tax policy standard, they say the limits that constrain changes in assessed or appraised value of property may appear to provide control, but actually distort the distribution of the property tax, destroying property tax equity, increasing public confusion and administrative complexity. So with all that said, MAO does oppose this proposal, and we oppose it for basically three reasons: the complexity of this proposal, the administrative burdensome part of this proposal, and the shifting of the tax burden that it creates. Thank you, and I would answer any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. May. Is there anyone else who would like to testify for or against? Mr. Cummings. Representative Rarick, was your question for Mr. May? Representative Rarick's got a question for you, Mr. May, before you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. May, I guess I have a question. Is the MAAO opposed to the tax-free zones that cities offer to incentivize new businesses to come in and build a new building?
Mr. May.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we're opposed to proposals or benefits that are put into the property tax system. If they're financed through a state program or through a city program, those are fine. We're not opposed to those at all. It's just when it skews the distribution of the property tax and adds administrative burden, that's when we're opposed to those items.
Representative Rarick? Thank you. Mr. Cummings.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I called Representative Joachim's office about this bill and about the important public goals that she's looking to attain. This bill authorizes a value exclusion for certain improvements to homestead and commercial industrial property. In essence, it revives the This Old House exclusion that is currently set to phase out and creates an additional exclusion that many have called This Old Business or This Old Shop. The bill would place value judgments for assessing properties that are not based on market value. We currently have many tools to recognize behaviors or situations in the tax code, including various class rates, credits, aids, and refunds. Sometimes tax credits are a blunt instrument used to go after a targeted goal. This proposal would exclude part of the value from the market value of a home or a business. This old house and limited market value were examples of programs that distorted the market by placing values on properties that were not linked to market value. The original intent of this old house was to keep historic homes from being raised, but it was used for other purposes, Mr. Chair. For example, many older homes had central air conditioning installed and received an exclusion for that rather than being needed structural updates. It may also allow for tax benefits to those with the excess income to make the updates to their home. In most, if not all, cases, it would increase their market value homestead exclusion, creating additional tax benefits that are not tied to market values. Under this bill, the phase-in provisions would be difficult to administer, and limited capabilities of assessment softwares to compute and correctly calculate the phase-in of excluded value. This required additional hands-on assessment work is more likely to have errors or could be forgotten than the computer-automated assessment issues. There were also issues with property that had multiple improvements or updates that had separate exclusions start years. And then phase-out years leading to multiple dates of review, phase-in, exclusion, etc. While the interactions with the tax base is complicated, one of the possible potential outcomes is that it could have interactions with local government aid based on older homes in a jurisdiction. Additional education and updating materials such as fact sheets, manuals, memos, bulletins, etc. would be needed. The DOR will be asked many statute interpretations questions, and the counties will be looking for guidance. So we look forward to working with you, Mr. Chair, Representative Joachim, the committee, and others if this bill does move forward. And we thank the committee for the opportunity to come and present today.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Anyone else would like to testify for or against the bill? Question from Representative Hertas.
Mr. Cummings.
I thought I was going to get away.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Cummings, believe it or not, we agree on this. However, as a policy manager for Department of Revenue, do you have some suggestions that we might use in place of this and probably more broadly? We all know that that investments in our communities and keeping housing stock in good shape inures to the value of all of the other homes around it, and certainly does support higher values. With our state statute right now with new construction, what I experience is a lot of people feel they don't have to do anything to their house for the first 10 years. And I would suggest to you that at 15 years, there's a lot of homes that need work. But to the extent that replacing the roof doesn't, it adds value because the next home buyer doesn't have to replace the roof for another 20 years, we understand that part. But how could we craft a system that would really encourage people to invest in their community and to keep their homes up and to keep the values up? What type of incentive policy would the department be supportive of to ensure that people aren't penalized through higher property taxes to invest in their home?
Mr. Cummings.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hertas and members, it's a very good question. So you ask a very good question, and as we're thinking about the property tax system, it's very complex. So there are opportunities to make changes within the property tax system that are very large, but then don't come on the state books, right? We don't have to. There isn't a payment that the state has to pay, but it could cause shifting and distortions within the property tax. And many times those are made because, you know, they don't have to be paid for. And so if the state is sort of actively interested in trying to provide ways in which people can think about investing in their homes, then maybe it is a way for the state to make direct investments or make direct grants out to individuals or others in order for them to invest in their homes. There's other thoughts. You know, there was something that the Office of Higher Education put out related to the student loan refinancing. It provided, for many individuals, it provided an easier way for them to be able to access thinking about how to refinance some of their student loans. And I'm not saying that that's directly applicable, but from the feedback that has been heard, many people saw that as a way that saw that as something very, very helpful for them in thinking about their own finances and about a way to access something that they wouldn't normally access. So I don't know if it's a way to provide people with thinking about or making it easier to finance or refinance these types of homes. But I guess I did not come prepared with an alternative. I'm just sort of thinking off the top of my head, Representative Hertas.
Okay. Representative Hertas, I've got two more people, and we need to be done with this one by quarter till.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'd like to talk to you about that offline.
Okay. Representative Whalen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Iwaki, I know we chatted about this a couple of years ago, and I completely understand where you're coming from, and I think the idea behind it and just wanting to offer those benefits is a really good thing. However, I do have some concerns and agree with the comments from Mr. May and Mr. Cummings that in seeking to provide this benefit, we're causing some large complications. And I think the potential consequences of that outweigh the potential benefits. But what I'm wondering is if you would be willing to look at financing it through a state program instead of a property tax, instead of within the property tax system.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Whalen and Representative Hertas. I am open to making it a blink off, not a phase in after the 10 years. I'm open to making it a state program and an incentive program if we're willing to tap into the general fund or the surplus to do that. I also just want to find a way to help business owners and homeowners improve their property because we know how important it is. I had some notes here that I was taking, and I'm trying to read them. I worry a little bit about the resistance the MAAO has on referrals, too, because we have a senior referral deferment program that's really important to our constituents and to our seniors. So, if they think all deferrals are bad, they you know, I worry about what they think about that program, too. So I look forward to working with the committee, with the chair, on ideas you might have, ways we can work with the Department of Revenue to find a program that would work, that would be, you know, easier to administer. You know, they have had experience administering it, so they've done it in the past. But I think, too, the phase-in, taking out the phase-in would be a big deal to make it more simplistic, so you'd have the 10-year deferment on the taxes, and then it would blink off. You wouldn't have to phase the price back in. But, no, I look forward to working with both of you on this.
Thank you. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And while there may be other ways to approach this, I think we do routinely shift tax burdens by our classification rates, by tax increment financing, by all kinds of different tools in our toolkits. And this one, I think, is particularly worthy because representing an area with housing that's turn of the century, the newest mostly, you know, old houses are and commercial properties and apartments are really hard to maintain. And when one of my neighborhoods had someone, you know, had the neighbors voluntarily go by each block and identify houses that needed work, and then we had a part-time person who went and approached the owners. It wasn't absentee owners as much as we expected. It was little old ladies who were scared stiff, knew their house needed work, but were afraid on a fixed income that their property taxes would go up, were intimidated by, you know, a future that they couldn't control. And this kind of thing is what allows people to age in place, to take care of what needs to be done. And I would just simply broaden it to also this old apartment. There's been proposals that we put hundreds of million dollars, and local governments are putting a lot of money into affordable housing because it's a shortage in all parts of the state. And a lot more attention is on naturally occurring affordable housing, and that's our older rental housing that also needs reinvestment if it's going to continue to stay affordable for the people who are dependent upon it. And so I think we need to be creative and keep working on this one.
Thank you. Well, members, we've had a good discussion, but let's continue here, and Representative Joaquin, kind of closing comment.
Yeah, I just want to say thank you for hearing the bill. Representative Loeffler brings up a good point. I did talk to the counties. There's a program for apartments in greater Minnesota that they're looking at bringing in to the metro area, so we'll have to talk about that. But, you know, it is a philosophical idea of, you know, is there a shift or not when the value wasn't there to begin with? And I do know with taxes there's always a push-pull, but I think there's a way we can figure out a program that's going to benefit everybody. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Joaquin renews her motion that House File 414 be laid over for possible inclusion. With that, House File 414 is laid over. And our last bill, Representative Sundin, House File 497 is moved by Representative Lunan.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House File 497.
Representative Lunan moves House File 497 to be entertained by the committee and then laid over for possible inclusion. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The committee 497 creates a tax, a special fire district, taxation district. Includes the cities of Cromwell and Wright, Minnesota, several townships as well. It's an improvement for the public safety in those communities. I have with me today a community activist and business leader in Cromwell, Minnesota, Mike Peterson. I have County Commissioner Gary Peterson. I've got 10 more Petersons lined up if necessary. We also have Mayor Sharon Zelazny and Fire Chief Lucas Gooden to complete the cast of characters to answer any questions or concerns of this committee. I'd like to have Mike Peterson make the case for this bill.
Thank you. Mr. Peterson, welcome. Please introduce yourself and proceed, sir.
Thank you, Chair, board members. I'm Mike Peterson. I'm Assistant Fire Chief, Cromwell Fire. And as you know, Gary Peterson's here. We're not related at all. But I want to share with you my grandfather when he came here. His name was Johnson, and he found out there was just too many Johnsons, you know, so he changed it to Peterson. So, yeah.
on behalf of the City of Wright, the City of Cromwell, the townships of Progress, Corona, Red Clover, Eagle, Wiesman, Lakeview, and one half of Hogan. We're here to present to you a special taxing district. And we, short history, the two departments, there's the fire department in Wright, the City of Wright, the fire department in Cromwell. We started training together about 10 years ago and found out that was working pretty well. We got together with a meeting with some of the government officials, and this is where the spark started for us to form the district, where some of these townships are concerned when they give their contract dollars to the city, they don't actually have to spend it on fire protection. So they were concerned where their dollars were going and where they actually going where they're supposed to. This way, if we do have a district, every tax dollar out there will be going to fire protection. There is a quiet crisis out there on volunteerism and fire services and ambulance services, and this is one way I feel we can strengthen our emergency services out there with these districts and working together. I just talked to the mayor of joining service, and he was interested in our district, how it works and so forth, and he wants me to come and talk to them because they're looking at this also. So I think this is going to be something in the future. I don't think it's going to stop, let's say, with just Cromwell, Wright, and those townships. I think I can foresee in the future that there'd be one fire service for our whole county of Carleton, and working together and providing expert services. With that, we'll be open for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Mr. Gary Peterson, would you like to speak, sir? Please introduce yourself and proceed, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. My name is Gary Peterson. I'm not related, but I'm a county commissioner for Carleton County. I represent the Wright Cromwell District. On this proposed taxing district, I would represent the unorganized townships that would be in this fire district. Our county board is in favor of this. I think, you know, being an old basketball coach, I think this is a slam dunk because I'm a retired teacher and coach, and I've seen so many school districts that have consolidated, you know, to be more efficient and provide better education for our students. And I think the same example can be provided for, you know, 5 miles apart, you have two separate, you know, fire departments. You know, the school district is combined already in, you know, Wright, Cromwell Wright School District. And I just think the people in this part of the county would be better served by this tax district. I don't know anybody that's opposed to it. But I'm hoping that you'll see that this is a good thing for us.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Other people who would like to testify? Welcome. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, committee, my name is Lucas Gooden. I'm the acting fire chief for the communities of Cromwell and Wright. This proposal that we have here is something that's grossly benefiting our community in regards to providing a service that is much needed in our communities as well as throughout the state. Unfortunately, like Assistant Chief Peterson here has already mentioned, volunteerism is something that is going by the wayside, and we're having significant troubles keeping members as well as providing services for our communities. This is something that is both benefiting the two cities as well as the additional townships and unorganized townships in our district. We are trying to provide a service that is difficult at best to manage on the best of times. And when we have multiple different systems that are redundant in the same area, which is what we were running into. We were trying to help our taxpayers and our communities provide one system that we don't have to continually buy additional equipment, additional training, and provide additional membership to have to go to training that is, quite frankly, not really something that's offered in our area in rural Minnesota. So we're trying to combine this service and create one taxing district. Therefore, we can hopefully help manage our taxpayers' money more directly and not have to have multiple services involved. And it's something that's been concerned or brought up as a concern for our communities that money is being moved through tax levies through our local townships and then being presented to the respective cities of Cromwell and Wright. Then those two organizations are then putting it in a account for the fire district, the Cromwell Wright Fire District. So money is being passed along in numerous different hands, and therefore taxpayers are rightly concerned that money is not being appropriated in the taxing district that they're paying for fire suppression as well as emergency medical services. With this proposed bill, it would certainly help us organize that, restructure it, and then allow our board with Mr. Gary Peterson being our chair for the Joint Powers District to help appropriate these funds and eliminate the middleman, so to speak. So we're here on behalf of our communities trying to help push this bill forward, and we would greatly appreciate your help and helping us with this, as well as Representative Sundin here authoring it for us. So we appreciate your time greatly.
Thank you, Mr. Gooden. Is there anyone else who would like to testify for or against the bill? With that, is Mr. Klayman, do you know or does anyone know how many of these types of districts we might have in the state? Does anyone, do we have other ones like this? Mr. Klayman?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, in the bill, under the definition, the first section of the bill, under the definition of special taxing district, we have a list of all the special taxing districts that have currently been authorized under law, and this one would be the, I guess, the 27th. And there's a number 27 as a more of a general
thank you
definition.
Thank you. Questions, members? Representative Hertaus and then Lunan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question to the testifiers is, as a past mayor of a community where we didn't have a fire department, we had a joint powers agreement with the cities of Hanover, with Rockford in another county adjacent to us, Greenfield, Medina, Loretto. So we had this joint powers agreement, and we aggregated all of the property value within the service district that the fire department was serving. And so each community knew what its share of having a budget to operate annually the fire service. So you have that levy authority now within the townships and within the local jurisdictions as part of your levy that you certify every year. You know in advance when you have a meeting of your joint powers agreement and set a budget, which is represented by each community participating in that, you have the ability to levy the money that you need. My concern about a special taxing district is you let this horse out of the barn that now has ambitions of creating a bigger, more expensive fire department than it really needs, and or the issues that came up in ours is wanting to have another adjoining community want to become part of our agreement or take it over because their pension plan was in trouble, where we were contributing regularly to our fire pension fund through the levy that each community would raise. So I guess in many respects, I think you already have the power to do what you're asking for, but it requires then the participation of all of those communities and the support of those communities for your budget.
Representative Lunan?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to point out when you're doing changes to a fire district or firefighting capability, just to avoid any unintended consequences, I would encourage you to approach ISO, which is the Insurance Service Organization, and if in fact you are increasing capabilities, then that should have a downward trend on what
your tax base pays in their property premium, the insurance on their buildings, whether they're commercial or residential. And then also be aware of that if you're consolidating and you're minimizing, to see if you can find out ahead of time that if we're going to get a tax savings from reducing, is that going to be more than offset by an increase in what those same property owners are going to have to pay for their property insurance, because the town class is what the term the insurance industry uses, is going to shift for you also. So you're going to want to have that data available when you pull the trigger or don't pull the trigger on this.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, may I address that?
Oh, sure. Mr. Gooden.
We have met with the ISO company just recently, in fact, and one of the recommendations was to continue with this joint powers agreement, as well as provide some additional equipment that would help with that. So we have been addressing that and been working with the ISO for quite some time already.
Thank you. Representative Anderson.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Just a quick comment. A lot of our small towns are facing the same problem that you evidently are, that volunteerism is not as strong as it used to be, hard to maintain your numbers. And I think anything we can do to help you to maintain your department and offer the folks up there the protection they need, I think we should go along with it, and I support the bill. So thank you.
Thank you. Members, any other questions, comments? Thank you for testifiers for coming today and for supporting and talking about the bill. Representative Sundin, any closing comments on the bill?
Chair.
Oh, Mr. Peterson, Mike.
Chair and Representative, I want to comment on your saying we already have the tools in place to make this work. And you're right, and in a way there's a lot of dynamic problems there. Right now we're joint powers, okay, but we don't have the authority. The two cities will not combine their funds. So we have a very hard time of trying to do a budget or put it together. Again, it's hard to get people to work together. To me, it's only a trust issue between the two cities, because the one city feels that the other one's going to use the money for something else. And that's what it comes down to, is why we're looking at this district, so we can put the money to where it's supposed to be. And when we're not putting this district together to save money, but we're hoping that we don't have to raise taxes as much in the future by combining more. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee. I'd like to thank all the testifiers for coming down and chiming in today. This is a very important bill for communities, rural communities, and most particularly I'd like to thank the committee members for some of the advice that they've offered here today. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Sundin. And I'm trying to remember, Representative Lunan moved this bill. Representative Lunan renews his motion that House File 497 be laid over for possible inclusion. And with that, we will lay over House File 497. Thank you all.
Thank you for your time.
With that, members, that completes our business for the day, and the meeting is adjourned.